So I'm in the center of Vilnius here on Savičiaus gatvė and Augustinio gatvė, right in the heart of Vilnius Old Town. And one thing which I have noticed since arriving is something which you may find slightly banal. Just to the left of me, I see a manhole cover with the word Vilnius, obviously Vilnius being the capital of Lithuania. To the right of me, I see another manhole cover written in Cyrillic, which says Lit SSR, so the Soviet Socialist Republic of Lithuania. So obviously this dates from Soviet times. And if I walk a few meters further, I see a heavy cast iron manhole cover stating Magistrat Miasta Vilna. So it is in Polish, so it obviously dates from before the Second World War. And again, it is stating in the language of the authority who is in charge of the city at a given time.
Dialogues on 20th Century History. Podcast by the European Network Remembrance and Solidarity. After the Great War, Vilnius, a disputed city. My name is John Beecham. I'm a Polish-British journalist and producer living in Poland. With a population of over 500,000, today's capital of Lithuania boasts a 700-year history. This can be noticed without too much effort, looking at one of the monuments standing on the square next to the cathedral, a massive bronze sculpture of the 14th century Grand Duke Gediminas is placed near a horse. The monarch holds a sword in his left hand and blesses the city with his right hand. During his rule, the area of Lithuania doubled in size. Duke Gediminas, as tourist brochures are all too eager to remind us, created a strong and influential state and extended its power to the east and to the south. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the modern Lithuanian national movement had no doubt where the capital city of a new state should be established.
Well, first of all, it was the historical capital city of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania,
reminds Dominik Wilczewski, a historian and journalist specializing in the modern relations between Poland and Lithuania.
And the new elites had their political ambitions. It was obvious for them that the new country, the new state that they are going to re-establish, the cultural, the political, the social center of this state should be in Vilnius.
Lithuanians had their own aspirations, and Vilnius seemed to be the best tool, whether symbolic or practical, to fulfill these aspirations. Darius Staliūnas, professor at the Lithuanian Institute of History and co-author of a book about the Vilnius question, explains which values appealed to the Lithuanian elite.
Lithuanians wanted to prove that they are not just a peasant nation, but that they are similar to Poles, Hungarians, and many other European nations, a historic nation that once had its own state, meaning the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. The best proof for that was Vilnius, because Vilnius was the capital of the Grand Duchy. And if you claim that you are a historic nation, you have to have that city within your national territory, because otherwise it would be difficult to prove for yourselves, but also for foreigners, that you are the same nation as the one that once had such a large state.
Another reason was related to the fact that in the neighborhood of the city, there was a population which Lithuanian elite claimed to be Lithuanians by origin.
Many of these people spoke one of the Slavic dialects, similar to Polish, Belarusian or Russian, but Lithuanians claimed that this is an ethnographic Lithuanian territory. And in Lithuanian ethnoculture, Vilnius was their own city, their capital. So it was in a folk culture also established that Vilnius is the city.
censuses held either by Russian authorities at the end of the 19th century or the German War Administration in 1916, showed that Poles and Jews dominated the population of Vilnius, somewhere between 70 and 90%, depending on the method applied to collect the data. Lithuanians were among the least numerous minorities. It represented 2.5% of the total number of inhabitants. But ethnically driven arguments tend to be tricky, Dominik Wilczewski underlines.
Lithuanians were on a rather weak position because ethnically Vilnius was dominated by Poles and Jews. So Poles had a stronger argument, taking ethnic perspective, to claim Vilnius as a part of the Polish state.
Grażyna Mareckaitė, a theatrologist born in Vilnius in the late 1930s to a Lithuanian family, puts it in a nutshell.
To idzie z czasów Gedymina, to wszystkie jego sentymenty, wszystkie historyczne.
It was the time of Gediminas that all sentiments and myths worked like that. Whoever feels these myths must be here.
However, historical and symbolic arguments which refer to sentiments and aspirations tend to collide with realpolitik and geopolitical circumstances. Tomas Balkelis, a senior researcher working at the Lithuanian Institute of History, focuses in his academic research on the Lithuanian national movement and the impact of the Great War on Lithuania. His last book describes nation-making processes in Lithuania after the Great War. And when we think about Vilnius in 1918, we have to remember that the city was in a state of constant turmoil, even after the Great War had formally ended, as Tomas Balkelis explains.
It is really a beginning of transitional periods, of transition from one war, from the Great War, to this huge post-World War I conflict that swept the whole borderland from the White Sea, from Finland, to the Black Sea, to Ukraine, Hungary, Romania. So Vilnius, at the end of 1918, becomes an epicenter of a new conflict. And basically, it's the beginning of the war. And the war comes with the withdrawal of the German Great Army, the Kaiser's Army, which is pushing back. German soldiers don't want to fight anymore. There's a revolution happening in Germany. And at the same time, there is a movement of the Red Army into the region, into this area of Kresy, of the Polish-Lithuanian, Belarusian, Ukrainian borderland.
Borderlands, hinterlands, yeah.
And, well, Vilnius, you know, is right at the center of these events. And at the same time, it is the city that is exhausted by the 4 years of war. And I just wrote a little piece about the starvation, hunger, that swept Vilnius from the fall of 1916, basically, to the fall of 1917, when about 8,000 or 9,000 people died from starvation and the epidemic of typhus. So it is the city which is really half starving. People are exhausted. It's very politically divided because you have not only Germans and Bolsheviks, but several political groups that are already quite organized and they want power. And in general, you have a collapse of state structures because the only state structures that existed during the war, during the Great War, were the German ones. It was the administration of the Oberost. And the Oberost is pulling back. On January the 4th, 1919, the last German soldiers are loading up their arms and they're leaving Vilnius train station for Kaunas. The German government decided not to defend Vilnius against the Bolsheviks. This decision basically raised the issue, who is going to control the city?
In leaving this power vacuum in Vilnius and the fact that it had gone through so much turmoil over the past years of the Great War, I mean, what happened next is just a recipe for disaster.
It is a recipe for disaster, and you have several armed groups emerging within the city. The strongest one is the Polish. Those are the veterans of World War I, the people that fought in the Polish corps as part of the Russian Imperial Army. Now they are ready to defend Vilnius against the Bolsheviks. There are about 2,500 of these Polish volunteer soldiers. It's not a big city, but it's really very splintered, divided, because you have the Poles that are arming, you have the Lithuanian army that is being created. It's a very tiny group, but it will expand very quickly because of the call for volunteers. Also, you have some Belarusians who are joining the Lithuanian side. They're organizing their own military unit. And finally, you have the local Bolsheviks who are armed. They are indulging in street fights with the Polish volunteers. So by the end of the year, actually on the first day of the new year of 1919, you have street fights happening between the Poles and the local Bolsheviks.
The Act of Lithuanian Independence was signed on the 16th of February 1918, without a commitment to the Central Powers, whose troops were still in Lithuania. After the German defeat, the boundaries of the Lithuanian state were still unsettled. From 1918 to 1920, Lithuania fought against both the Bolsheviks and the Western Russian Volunteer Army in the so-called Wars of Independence. In those circumstances, Lithuanians decided to pull back from the city, as Tomas Balkelis points out.
In the end, it turned out they were not able to find Lithuanian army at this time. I'm talking about the end of the year. It's made up primarily of officers of Lithuanian origin, and it's about 80 or 100 people. It's a tiny group, you know.
So it's like a kind of paramilitary unit.
Yeah, it's totally paramilitary. And, well, the Lithuanians leaving together with the Germans. So Lithuanians leave by train to Kaunas on January the 2nd, 1919, and the Germans leave 2 days later. So the city is basically defended only by the Polish troops. And the Red Army is pushing very hard. The size of the Red Army is much greater than the size of the Polish Samobrona troops. And there are some street fights, and the Red Army is kind of attacking from several directions, and the Polish troops, they're not able to put any kind of stronger resistance, and they are pulling back. Finally, there's a decision to pull back from the city because the Polish city magistrate, they also asked for the leadership of the Polish Samobrona to leave the city, fearing that when the Bolsheviks come in, they may institute terror against the civilian population of the city. Just in a few days, a Lithuanian from Soviet Russia arrives by the name of Vincas Mickevičius Kapsukas, and he becomes a head of a new socialist republic of Lithuania. And this is, you know, the Bolshevik attempt to build a Soviet Lithuania, and this will go on for several months until the new eruption of war in the city. Between the Polish regular army, headed by Pilsudski himself, and the Bolsheviks.
That was not the final act of Piłsudski's involvement in the Vilnius question, Dominik Wilczewski adds. After the Poles won the Battle of the Vistula and defeated the Soviets in August 1920, Lithuanian troops entered the city. 2 months later, the Polish side reacted and took over Vilnius.
Vilnius was lost through the military action by the general Lucjan Żeligowski, who was acting on the order of Józef Piłsudski, but it was unofficial. It was seen as a treacherous and deceitful act by Poles, so it was the reason that Polish-Lithuanian relations deteriorated in later years.
Piłsudski, perceived in Poland as the father of independence and the winner of the war with the Red Army and Soviet Russia, had a real and strong mandate in Polish society.
For the Poles, you know, it was quite obvious that, for the majority of the Poles, that Vilnius should belong to the new Polish state, because Vilnius was a cradle of the Polish culture, the city of Adam Mickiewicz, and there was no question for Piłsudski, you know, that one way or the other, Vilna should be tied to Poland. But the Polish strategy basically was to rely on their own strength and also on the support of the Western powers. Because the Western powers in the United States and England, and especially France, they believed, you know, that in the future, during the interwar period, the only security guarantee in the region could be the emergence of a greater Poland, a strong Polish state that would serve as a buffer zone, as a buffer state against another possible threat from the East, from Soviet Russia. In a certain sense, I would say it is a curse of Polish, you know, politics at the time, because, as you know, Poland was the state that during this period from 1918 to 1923 had to fight five wars. And most of them happened in the Kresy. So there was a war against Soviet Russia. To say it very briefly, the strategies of these new nation states, you know, to establish some kind of, you know, keepable borders, you know, developing their armies, and also trying to, how to say, proselytize, agitate among local populations. Lithuanians developed this argument that actually the majority of population in the Vilnius region and in the city itself, even if they are Polish speakers, they're not real Poles. They are kind of, you know, Polonized Lithuanians. That was, you know, the argument at the time. These conflicts, initially they started as, you know, tensions between two different national movements. The beginning of this conflict lies at the end of the 19th century, in the 1880s, when there were some Lithuanian intellectuals who started discussing common historical past with Poles and claimed, you know, their own statehood as separate from Polish statehood. So it was basically, you know, the revision of the history of the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And after the Great War and after the emergence of these two nation states, Poland and Lithuania, this conflict between national movements, conflict which was basically about rhetoric, about words, then it turns into political structures, states which have their power apparatus, which have their armies, they have their propaganda machines, and they indulge in international war against each other.
So I'm standing outside the Halles Turgus, so the market hall here in downtown Vilnius. We're a stone's throw away from the main railway station. And to the other side of me, we have the entrance to the old town. Now, what is interesting about this hall is that, yes, of course, we can still go here and still do our shopping. It's pretty much open every day, apart from Mondays. But it was built in 1906, so at a time after the 1905 revolution, at a time when there was more and more thinking about demolishing the old order to make way for the new. The one thing we can do when walking into this hall is still hear and speak the amount of languages which would still be heard all those years ago. You have to remember that in those days, Vilnius was Polish, it was Jewish, it was Tatar, it was Karaim, it was Lithuanian, and all these nationalities would come here to a place like this, the main market hall, to do their weekly shopping. But walking down the hall here, you can still feel that sense. Because, of course, food, something which doesn't change over the years. People are used to eating. No matter where they come from, they will still eat the same kinds of things. And here we have, you know, plentiful vegetables, fruit. We have some amazing cured meats of the kind which, you know, people living here all those years ago would be eating as well. Now, one thing which is why we've stopped here, one thing which is very, very specific to this area are pickled vegetables. So, of course, no people who like Eastern Europe or know about the cuisine of Eastern Europe will obviously immediately recognize the pickled gherkins. But here we also have pickled tomatoes, pickled garlic, pickled cabbage, pickled peppers, pickled courgettes. And it's just amazing to see. And the smell, oh my lord, this is absolutely fantastic. It makes me want to, you know, it makes my mouth salivate at the very thought of having this on my breakfast table in the mornings.
To bardzo fajna też kiełbaska suszona, taka twardzieńka, suchinka i taki sam jest Hindujczyk.
And just by walking around this market hall and looking at the food on offer and listening to the language, it just goes to show the long-lasting effects of multiculturalism in this city. And one thing, on the one hand, you have all the violence, whether it be social or physical, between the competing minorities in this city, whereas all that just simply flies out the window in a market hall like this, where every language is treated equally, and if you know even a little bit of Lithuanian or a little bit of Polish, you will be able to get what you want.
Since Vilnius was attached to Poland in 1922, which was perceived in Lithuania as occupation, Kaunas was chosen as a provisional capital. The loss of this city became a collective trauma that deeply affected Lithuanian identity.
And that could be explained also with the help of some even biological terminology.
Darius Staliunas points out.
What nationalists do, they create a concept of a national territory, which is a kind of very similar thing like a body.
Like a living organism, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And there are some important parts of this body and some which are not that important. So when you create that concept, in your understanding, all parts of this body are more or less important, but the Vilnius was the most important part of this national geobody. And to prove that, we can remember that it was called the heart of Lithuania. So the heart was taken out of the body and now it belongs to another foreign body.
In the Lithuanian constitution, Vilnius remained the capital of Lithuania. Dominik Vilčevski says it showed the enormous determination of the Lithuanian national movement to regain the city.
It was, I would say, a mixture of different attitudes, but the feeling that Vilnius should be a part of Lithuania was overwhelming. There was no discussion. The main goal was to regain Vilnius one way or another.
Although the Great War gave hope to fulfill the aspirations of various national movements, a nationalist-driven discourse did not stop growing after 1918. Politics aimed at nation-building influenced even such particular and seemingly neutral practices as care for displaced and abandoned children whose parents died of diseases or during military actions. Vilnius, poor, hungry and devastated, also had to deal with this problem. Historian Dr. Andrea Grifante analyzed how Lithuanian orphanages acquired an ethno-national character and entered the field of political competition with the Polish child assistance institutions.
National intelligentsias used to collect people, to collect young people in order to nationalize them. Young people did not understand this help in the same way as the intelligentsia did. And namely, they used to stay at one national group's facility just in order to be fed and to have a shelter. Different national relief committees started to implement their nation-building strategies and used the tool of social control in order to further their nation-building processes within the walls of these orphanages.
Okay, so these kids were given, let's say, food and shelter, but were they kind of conditioned in any way, depending on the institution that was giving them shelter? So, you know, if you're in a Polish one, you'd obviously be taught Polish historical values or even the modern national values along ethnic lines, which emerged at that time. What was the situation there?
People sheltered in hostels or in orphanages were supposed to attend school and also to attend recreational activities for orphans or for hosted children only. Namely, during these recreational activities, people were taught, actually, national myths, national songs, popular songs, national content was absolutely evident. They could learn how to be a good Pole or a good Lithuanian. Nation building was carried on also through food. If these young people were not eager to take part in these activities, they could not be given food. People from Polish orphanages who went out and stayed at night at Lithuanian orphanages were also not given food, were also pulled out of school. On the other side, we can see also examples of people that, due to their eagerness to be good Lithuanians, good Poles, due to their good marks, for example, at school, were given way to further education for free, or were given a job, and so on. So there was a kind of circuit in which nationality and the social matters were quite connected to one another.
Thomas Balkelis adds one more factor which shaped people's lives in the post-war city: constant violence.
It comes with the Great War, with the massive movement of the Russian and German armies fighting each other. And this regime, the Oborost, that operates in Lithuania from 1915 to 1918, is very violent in the sense that it carries arbitrary justice. Many civilians are being shot. You have a massive expansion of banditry as a result of German forced labor schemes imposed on Lithuanian society. Those are the people who are armed, hiding in forests, and they are robbing the local population to survive. So they're killing, they're looting. So my point here is that this violence is already there, and the society is already acquainted with violence, and violent ways of conflict resolution, they become legitimized by the war, first of all. So when 1918 comes and you have another war, these violent ways of solving the conflict, they become totally legit, because people think, you know, that this way of resolving conflicts is totally fine. Violence was legitimized, first of all, by these new political groups that started fighting each other after 1918, by the Lithuanian nation state, by the Soviet Russia, by the new Polish state, and by the new Ukrainian state. All of these states, at the time, they're pretty much violent. A lot of this violence spills out against civilians, because civilians, they become targets of national agitation campaigns. Civilians are being mobilized for each of these national projects. At the same time, we shouldn't be so violence-oriented, you know, because alongside violence, there were some other political, you know, state-building processes happening, like political mobilizations, you know, the emergence of Lithuanian, for example, popular culture, Polish, you know, national culture. The war was happening alongside the building of these societies in very peaceful and civilian ways. If we're going to make a claim that it was all about violence, I think we're going to provide kind of too simplified way of the history of the emergence of these new societies and states.
I'm in the Museum of Vilnius here, and there's an exhibition of buildings which were never constructed since Vilnius changed hands so many times. We have Polish plans, we have Lithuanian plans, we even have German and Soviet plans. One of these plans, which I'm looking at now, is a plan dating from 1936 by architects Kazimierz Byszewski and Zbigniew Byszynacki, and it's a competition entry for the upgrading of the Cathedral Square. Extremely political, you can see. We have here, it says the forum, we see a specific place where we would have a memorial to Marshal Józef Piłsudski, you know, one of the great Polish statesmen. So the Poles really wanted to show their domination of the city by creating public spaces which would be reflective of the state's great power. And we have grand promenades, and we have arteries, and we have Main Street, Mickiewicz Street, and then we would also have, at the end of the Main Street, we see on the architectural plan a parade square where there would be an altar for the masses, Catholic masses of the Polish garrison stationed here in the interbellum.
The Lithuanian minority in interwar Vilnius, according to censuses held by the Polish authorities, represented about 1% of the total population of the city. They were not numerous, but well organized. Most of them belonged to the intelligentsia. They had their own theater, political parties, a hospital, private schools, newspapers, art exhibitions. Leaders of the Lithuanian community belonged to the generation educated in the former Russian Empire. In their work, they especially cared for the language. Jurgis Šlapelis and his wife Marija Šlapeliene ran a bookshop which became a place where Lithuanians gathered. Linguist, physician and literary critic Jonas Basanavičius founded, just before the Great War, the Lithuanian Scientific Society and for 20 years remained its president. The younger generation acted in slightly different circumstances.
In his school diaries, he writes in Lithuanian. So I think, of course he spoke Polish and Belarusian and Lithuanian and Russian. So it's this mixture of Kresy.
Says Professor Marija Dremaitė, a scholar specializing in the history of architecture, and speaking about her grandfather, Vladas Drema, an art historian and painter. Drema was one of the most visible members of the Lithuanian community in the interwar period. And because of his involvement in the city's art world, he could befriend many people. However, as his biographer, Professor Giedrė Jankevičiūtė, explains, the interwar zeitgeist made him feel strongly about his nationality.
Of course, Drema didn't feel himself very comfortably being part of a national minority. He left a number of autobiographies, and almost in all of them, the tension between Lithuanians and Polish authorities and the effects of this tension on his personal life are mentioned. For example, Drema was convinced that it was Polish hostility to national minorities, Lithuanians in particular, the reason why he was not admitted to the Faculty of Architecture at the Warsaw Polytechnic, where he had tried to enroll after he graduated from the gymnasium. After graduating from the Handicraft Institute in Warsaw, he was not proposed to come to teach to any Polish school of Vilnius, but started to work as a teacher in Russian gymnasium. The case is quite telling. It was much easier for medical doctors and even the lawyers of non-Polish origin to integrate than for the artists and teachers, whose profession was more closely linked to cultural identity and its formation. From the other hand, when Drema recalls his studies at Vilnius University, he stresses that Faculty of Art was an exception there. And the relationship among the students of different nationalities were really good in art faculty.
I am entering the house of Gražina Mareckaitė, a theatrologist born in Vilnius in late 1930s to a Lithuanian family. Her grandparents came from central Lithuania. After the outbreak of the October Revolution, they left for the Caucasus, and in 1918 arrived to Vilnius with their 7 children and a strong conviction of staying there.
18 rok, Litva, już nepodleglos.
1918. independent Lithuania. That was the reason they came to Vilnius. Lithuanians started coming to Vilnius after the 1905 revolution. They hoped that it would be the capital of the new Lithuanian state. There was hope, but it had to be abandoned quickly. My parents stayed in Vilnius because they came from this area, from Dovgelishki, and they felt connected to this land. They felt close to this place. Their roots were here.
One of Gražina Mareckaitė's uncles established the Lithuanian Scout Association in the mid-1920s. The organization aimed at maintaining national identity. Gražina Mareckaitė recalls quite an astonishing situation from 1938, when Poland delivered an ultimatum to Lithuania as a consequence of the refusal to have any diplomatic relations with Poland after 1920, protesting the annexation by Poland of the Vilnius region.
One of my uncles, the one who was the head of the scouts, had a duel. And then a student spoke offensively to my uncle, and he challenged him to a duel. They were supposed to fight with swords, but the uncle couldn't, so he took some lessons from a Polish officer. All the Lithuanian press wrote about this duel, all the newspapers, and my uncle won. They fought until the second blood. The uncle wounded his opponent in the shoulder. Then there's a legend. In 1940, they were both deported by the Soviets to Siberia, and there their relationship changed.
Hostility and harmony was like love and hate in interwar Vilnius. Although Vladas Drema wrote a lot about the malevolence of the Polish authorities toward the Lithuanian minority, many of his closest friends were Poles.
He was frank that he admired many Polish artists and intellectuals. He also read widely in Polish. Drema's contacts with his Polish friends continued even after they left Vilnius for Poland after the war. Drema's daughter recalled that her father was particularly close with a print artist, graphic artist Kristina Wróblewska and Romana Gintilówna. Policy of the Polish government did not prevent personal relationships and friendships based on the professional interest and mutual affection.
And that is not all I learned about Drema's family.
Probably more interesting when he was at the University of Stefan Batory in Vilnius University. And there we can see that Lithuanian, Belarusian, Jewish minorities separated themselves very clearly from the Polish students, because they treated themselves also, and they were treated as minorities. He was more friendly with Belarusians of Vilnius than Poles of Vilnius. But his wife was Polish, so it's my grandmother was Polish, and it was in the family that we are very Vilniusian.
These were Dialogues on 20th Century History, a podcast by the European Network Remembrance and Solidarity. ENRS is funded by the Ministries of Culture from Poland, Germany, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania. This podcast was created with the support of the Federal Institute for Culture and History of the Germans in Eastern Europe. Production, Free Range Productions.